Welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, my co-host as always, Arsene Keshkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, joining us here at KGNU with a returning author. And who have we been reading for the month of January?
We've been reading Edward Hamlin, and his book is Sonata in Wax, a novel. Last time he was here, we did a book of short stories of his, so it's kind of fun to dig into a big, meaty novel.
We are delighted to have Edward join us. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
This book is fascinating. It's a great read and story in and of itself, but the personal connection you have to much of what's happening is really fascinating. So we're going to explore that. But Sonata in Wax, the sonata in question, is a French sonata. It's a piece of music that really is at the heart of this story, which navigates two different timelines a century apart. And we really delve into the meaning of music, the impact on the performer and the audience, and especially the impact of this particular sonata. So, as I said, this is a personal connection to you because you are, in fact, a musician. So can you tell us a little bit about your own musical tendencies and why you wanted to bring that into your writing?
Sure. Well, I'm not a classical musician. I play acoustic jazz mostly. It's hard to classify exactly what it is, but that's the closest. So I compose a lot of music and I play a lot of music, and I'm interested in kind of the psychology of composition. I feel like I've been playing for 51 years. I just figured out the other day. And so I've evolved as a composer, I've evolved as a player. And I'm just fascinated by that as a writer because I'm involved in a creative process there too. And there's always been an interesting interplay for me between the improvisational aspects of playing music and the improvisational aspects of writing prose. So I think from that point of view, I was always interested in writing about music, though everybody warns you against it. And I guess from a musician's point of view, that's one key piece. The other key piece is I've just been in love with a certain period of French piano music for longer than I can remember. And that's kind of early 20th century Satie, Ravel, Fauré, these early modernist composers. And it's music that really speaks to me emotionally and musically. And so I always wanted to write somehow about that.
So in the book, a sonata is discovered. It's on these like wax cylinders. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But how did you, so when it's heard 100 years later, it blows people away. So how do you construct a sonata that supposedly was played in 1917 and make it blow people away in 2018? Mm-hmm. And what went through your mind? What were the elements? Because you give a lot of details about the different movements of the sonata.
Yeah, I mean, it has elements that seem way ahead of its time. And so there are some, you know, musicological things that are, you know, pretty much over my head, but there are harmonies, there are rhythmic things that it's doing that if you kind of look at the history of 20th century classical music, nobody was doing that then. And so, in a way, when Ben, my character, my main protagonist in the contemporary storyline, hears it, he recognizes that immediately. And he thinks, how in the world? Like, who is that masked man? You know, who was the composer? Who was the pianist on this recording? They're both amazing. And how in the world did this person have the foresight, the vision, to anticipate things that came out of 50s bebop? You know, how in the world could that have been happening in World War I America and or France, as he thought at the time? So I had a lot of fun trying to figure out what it sounded like. It's a fictional sonata. And, you know, how does this brilliance and this visionary aspect actually translate into the music? So I had a lot of fun with that.
I did wonder if you actually had the music written down anywhere, if you could actually hear it because you describe it so vividly. Mm-hmm. Because this is part of the story, Ben trying to figure out and transcribe the score as well from these wax cylinders that contain the music.
Yeah. No, I don't have it written down, and it probably would be beyond my transcription capabilities. I'm not Ben. But I do have a pretty clear interior listening to it. You know, I think I can hear what a lot of it sounds like. Not the Allegro movement, too many notes. But there's a little folk song that sort of flits through it that turns out to be a French folk song. I can kind of hear that. I can hear some of the opening movements of the sonata, some of the themes. So in my mind, it partially exists. It's sort of shrouded in a little bit of mystery still.
So Ben gets this, as Maeve said, these wax cylinders. And, you know, he's a producer. He's won Grammys. You know, he's really, you know, kind of the pantheon of the behind the control board of classical music, you know. So talk about these cylinders and how could they have been preserved for 100 years? And and talk about Ben a bit, too, and why is he the perfect person to get them?
Okay. So just factually or historically, the wax cylinders, and I have a couple. I'll show the two of you. I can't show the radio audience, but I'll show the two of you. They were invented by Edison in the late 1800s, and they were one of the earliest attempts to create a recording technology that could reproduce music, or speech was the first, you know, target, in a repeatable way. And the earliest versions of them used foil, like a tin foil, I think. And so it could reproduce it about three times. And then the stylus would destroy the foil. So the wax cylinders were the first, you know, really viable and commercially viable technology for reproducing music. And you think of it just like a phonograph record, except in a cylinder format. So one thing that was really different about those from phonograph records, which immediately replaced them, is that it was a read-write medium. So if you bought a graphophone, which was Alexander Graham Bell's device for playing Edison cylinders, if you had a graphophone in your home, you could not only play commercial content. You know, Edison was way ahead of his time thinking about music as IP. Intellectual property. And so he had built this catalog of stuff that you could order and pay for. But you could also buy blanks and record your drunken uncle's dinner time, you know, speech at Christmas dinner, or you could record your own piano playing in your parlor. It was a two-way format. And of course, that's fundamental to the storyline, because our composer, who is also our performer, you know, is able to record the sonata in this mansion outside of Boston. And those cylinders are lost soon thereafter. I don't want to give any spoilers, but they wind up in an antique shop in Belfast, Maine. And the owner of that antique shop eventually sends them to Ben. And because of his stature as a, you know, the go-to classical producer, she wants him to figure out if this is any kind of meaningful piece of music. What is it? It sounds weird to me. She's not a musician. She doesn't know much about classical music. It really sounds odd. Is there a there? Is there anything like special about this? And so these cylinders arrive from this woman that he doesn't know. And it's just a job. It's a gig. He's going to be paid to do it. And he has to first restore the audio, which is very corrupted. The cylinders have been damaged over the years. And then when he hears the music, which is the first page of the novel, he gets it. You know, and then he says, wow, this is just beyond anything that I could imagine from that time era.
So the novel is straddling two timelines a century apart. It's Ben in the contemporary timeline who's has these cylinders and he's trying to decipher what it is and fill in the blanks because, of course, you know, some of the information is missing. But then we also are transported to 100 years earlier when the music is actually being played. And you said that this was recorded in a mansion. And I mentioned earlier that this book is very much connected to you personally because of your love of music and you being a musician. But also there's a family connection mm-hmm. because the mansion in question belongs to the Sanborn family, of which you are a descendant.
I'm actually the last living descendant.
You were the last living Sanborn. So who were the Sanborns?
Yeah. So I doubt you had it in Ireland, but in the United States, there was a, you know, big consumer brand of coffee, Chase and Sanborn Coffee. And it was sort of one of the great American brands of the late 19th century and into sort of the mid 20th century. You can still buy it if you're a masochist about your coffee. It's not very good. But they did a lot of innovations. They were the first company to invent the idea of vacuum-sealed food. They were the first company to stale-date food, in which case there are some very funny old ads for Chase and Sanborn about dated coffee. They were kind of promoting their dated coffee. But anyway, my great-great-grandfather was the Sanborn of Chase and Sanborn. He was a tea merchant from Maine originally and founded this company right after the Civil War with Chase. And they quickly moved from tea to coffee and, built this great American brand and made a ton of money. And then in the next generation, James Sanborn's eldest son built this mansion in Winchester, Massachusetts, about a 20-minute drive from Boston, and raised his five children there, one of whom was my grandmother, Helen Sanborn, who's in the book. And that first generation, after the patriarch's generation, basically squandered the family fortune. And Orrin Sanborn, who dips in and out of the story now and then, mostly pretty drunk, he's the one that really was, you know, buying the yachts and playing the horses and who knows what else. And so by the time I came around, I mean, my generation, none of that money came down to us. It was all gone. But my grandmother, who's in the book, was the sort of hinge generation who grew up, you know, as a Boston Brahmin, a very wealthy Bostonian socialite, but her parents divorced. The family fortune was lost, and so she had to kind of land on her feet, create a life for herself. She actually did buy an antique shop, and so she was a powerful woman, a really interesting character.
I heard you say in a previous interview you didn't inherit any of the money, but you inherited a lot of stories.
Yeah.
Which we'll dig into, because obviously, you know, as a inspiration mm-hmm. for this book, there must have been some stories, or was there a musical performance at the mansion that you had heard about? I mean, what element in reality is there?
So there were a lot of cultural events that the Sanborns hosted, not only musical performances by, you know, members of the Boston Symphony and the Boston Pops. Arthur Fiedler bounced my father on his knee, famously. He was the artistic director of the, you know, popular orchestra. And so they also hosted these, they called them tableaux, which was basically reenacting scenes from classical literature in full costume. And I do have some photos of my grandmother and others, you know, out in the portico of the mansion, you know, dressed in ancient Greek robes and so forth, reenacting scenes from, you know, Sophocles. So they would have these. They had my great-grandmother, Rena Sanborn, hosted candlelight teas, where she would have in various kinds of performers and so forth. So there was a lot of music happening there. There was not the recording of this fictional sonata, obviously. But they were cultured people.
So in that time period in your book, when you go back to, I think it stretches maybe from 1915 to 19, I think. Mm-hmm. So Helen Sanborn is a character there, but she's not the main character.
Right.
Elizabeth Garnier, is that mm-hmm. how you say her
Garnier.
Name? Mm-hmm. She she's the character. She's a young woman, maybe 20 or so, and it's her family that has the music, mm-hmm. and so but she's of a different class. And I thought in that earlier time period, the difference in classes was pretty clear. Mm-hmm. And that seemed like that was something that was very important to the story, to show how bifurcated maybe these class differences were. Mm-hmm. But so I guess my question would be, you know, so talk about Elizabeth and her relationship to this Sanborn family and how precarious her existences, which is the irony, of course, as you mentioned, is Helen ends up having a precarious existence after all the money's squandered. But that's not when Elizabeth meets that family. She's precarious, and that family seems as solid as you can be.
Right. Yeah. Well, Elizabeth is French. She's 24, actually, in the main part of the book. And her father was a pianist who, you know, was roommates with Debussy and was part of that incredibly rarefied set of composers from around that time. And he has a great career ahead of him, potentially as a concertizing pianist in France. But for reasons I won't go into until you read the book, they wind up coming to America instead. And he's promised a slot in the Boston Symphony that falls through and various, you know, enticements, none of which comes to pass. And so he winds up being a piano teacher in Boston Latin School, making not much money. And they live in Roxbury in a not very, you know, nice neighborhood. But he's still a passionate composer and pianist. That doesn't go away. And so their circumstances change a lot. They came from a French bourgeois background, you know, a small town in Normandy. They're not rich in France, even. But they're a lot poorer once they come to Boston. And so his daughter is a bright, educated, modern woman of the time. She has a degree in social work. She's, committed to building a life for herself. But because of some circumstances that arise, she's sort of forced to go to work. And the work that she gets into is selling these graphophones for Alexander Graham Bell's company. But because she's educated, European, pretty, she winds up being assigned to sell graphophones to the rich. There were different grades of graphophones. And so rather than the sort of consumer simple grade that pretty much any middle class family could afford, they have a sort of juiced up one that has, you know, beautiful silver and gold appointments and so forth. And so her job is to go and call on these wealthy, wealthy families in Boston and sell the high end graphophone to them. And that's how she meets the Sanborns. And when she goes to a garden party that turns out to be a women's suffrage rally, or fundraiser, she meets Helen Sanborn, who is this somewhat younger daughter of the Sanborn, you know, Orrin Sanborn. And Helen sort of adopts her. You know, Elizabeth is able to make her way in the world because she's French. That appeals to the sort of arriviste, upward climbing, social climbing Sanborns. And she's, you know, cultured to a level that is opening doors for her among this set. So they form this sort of unlikely friendship. And Helen kind of pulls her into the world of the Boston Brahmins. Elizabeth has her doubts about some of that. And her father is, of course, in the background as a very important driver in her life.
Yeah, she's never quite comfortable with that, with it being that upper class. Like, she's comfortable with Helen as a friend, but
yeah,
she feels it's pretty precarious, her hold on that
yeah.
status. I wanted to ask you to read a piece. This will take us back to the contemporary timeline with Ben, mm-hmm. and it'll involve who becomes one of the other main characters, Anna. Mm-hmm. And so, but I thought it was beautiful in how Ben's reaction to Anna's playing, I think, is really beautiful.
Yeah. So Ana Clara Matta is a Brazilian piano superstar, a concert pianist who's especially revered for her interpretations of this music period that I was talking about, the kind of early 20th century. She is the person. And she's a bit of a prima donna. So this is a recording session. She's recording a series of Debussy pieces, and this is a recording session with Ben behind the controls. At the piano, Ana Clara pulls on her famous Punjabi slippers with their goat leather soles and ornate beadwork. There can be no performance without them. She once delayed a recital in Berlin for 40 minutes while a panicked minder dashed from the Konzerthaus to the Ritz-Carlton to retrieve the forgotten footwear, an incident that did not amuse the Germans. Now she stretches her body systematically, curling left and right, twisting gently on the bench, working her fingers one by one. The troubled forearm receives a brisk, expert massage. She goes through her paces like a runner preparing for a championship sprint, her concentration supreme, her thin lips drawn to a frown. "Go," she says finally, nodding toward the control booth. And with a click of the mouse, Ben starts recording. Debussy's music begins to flow from the Steinway's hammers, pulsing across gold-spattered microphone diaphragms, through cables, and into the mixing console where it sets a bank of meters in motion. On the wide computer monitor, a green waveform begins to scroll by, tracking the heartbeat of the canope. Ana Clara's artistry floods through the low-lit studio like sunlight through rain, the Steinway crystal clear, the music ineffable. Ben is so easily seduced by such moments. They still move him as nothing else can. He lets out a long sigh, unaware that his breathing is falling into step with the left-hand part of the Debussy, shadowing Ana Clara's every move. Without thinking, he nudges a fader up, watching his meters. On the technical level, all is well. The sound is sweet and true. It's the player's emotion that captivates him, and, hovering just over his shoulder, the composer's. He does feel Debussy, or his idea of him, in the booth. A smoker's voice, a staccato laugh, a scent of hair oil. A way of walking into a room. Fingers nearly as slender as Mata's, nails trimmed like a surgeon's. The music makes it all perfectly clear. Ben studies his artist through the soundproof window. The sleekly tapered back arched slightly above the piano bench, the nest of dark curls tied back with a cream scarf to accommodate the headphones that she, unusually among players at her level, prefers to wear. The Punjabi slippers sure insensitive on the pedals. As she comes to a minor phrase, she closes her eyes and turns her narrow face toward the ceiling, leaning into it, only to bring her head back down in a long arc as she resolves to major. The hint of a smile crosses her face. She has so much to say to the composer. As Ben listens, it's as if he's eavesdropping. So intimately does she converse with Debussy's ghost, all her sensitivity and intelligence devoted to its handiwork.
That's Edward Hamlin reading from his latest book, Sonata in Wax. And he's our guest for the month of January in the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. You spoke earlier, Edward, about your interest in the psychology of music or music psychology and the way you've, you know, when you were reading that, and that's what really struck me. There's so many passages in the novel about the impact on the listener, the impact on the performer, but just the psychological impact of music. It's so powerful. I mean, talk a little bit more about that. And did you observe in a very specific way for research for the book, or was this really just something that you've always experienced, this kind of really deep impact listening to this kind of music?
Yeah, no, I think it's my own personal experience. I mean, I think all of us probably have some memories of musical moments that just knocked us over, you know. And I mean, it's said to be notoriously difficult to write about music itself, but you can always write about the way music affects your character. And if you're any good as a writer, you should be able to to delve into that, to describe that. And so, I mean, I think I had my own very personal reference points that had nothing to do with classical music in most cases. There was, you know, I attended an Indian classical concert in college, and the violinist, you know, absolutely tantalized the audience for probably 10 minutes by playing everything but the note that you wanted to hear. And at a certain point, he took a deep breath. I can still feel it and see it. And drew his bow and pulled that note. And everyone died. I mean, it's moments like that that are, I think, relatable to any reader and translatable between genres of music. So I certainly looked at that. And then there's a real piece, not a fictional piece, that plays into the plot by Lily Boulanger, who was the little sister of Nadia Boulanger, who, as a teacher of composition, taught some of the great composers of the 20th century. But Lily, her younger sister, is not as well known, but was a brilliant composer who died very, very young. She was the first woman to win the Rome Prize. She had perfect pitch. She was a really interesting figure in classical music, but unfortunately, career cut very short by what we now think might have been Crohn's disease. Anyway, she had written these three fragments, these three short pieces, 2 minutes each. And I stumbled across one of those in my research, and that grabbed me. I mean, there is this, I talk about it multiple times in the book, but there's a descending passage in one of those fragments that to this day floors me. And so it floors Ben too. And he thinks he hears some connection to a section of the sonata, the fictional sonata. And that's kind of like his first way into figuring out its provenance. So that's one that I think is in the book, but also really, really moves me as a piece of music.
You know, when you read that passage, I was really struck by the foreshadowing. You know, that passage, I think, is page 18. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot in there. Like, Anna seems to be conversing with the ghost of the composer. Mm-hmm. Later on, Ben, as he tries to transcribe the sonata over and over again, he feels like the ghost of the composer is in the house with him.
Yeah.
You know, and there's other aspects of there. And I guess as a writer, you know, are you writing this in later, or you put this in and these naturally echoes happen? You know, like, what's the process there? Because I was really, well, the first time you read it, it doesn't occur to you because you haven't read the rest of the book. Yeah. But now that I've read the rest of the book, I'm like, wow, like there's so much in this passage that tells you what's going to go on in the book.
Sets it all up, yeah. And I had actually not made that connection until you said it about Ben feeling the ghost of the, you know, the sonata composer. So thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's unconscious. Some of it is, you know, very deliberately planting seeds and foreshadowing. I mean, I certainly did plenty of that. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is going on below the level of the writer's consciousness, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what somewhat makes it so delightful. And as a reader, it's really funny because when I read it, it didn't echo back to this. But to read it again, I guess this is an advertisement for reading the book twice. Hardback and paperback.
Exactly, yes.
Is there an audiobook version? And if so, how much music is in it?
Yeah, there isn't. My agent is working on that. And my wife is pressuring me to record it, to be the narrator of it. And of course, I mean, the same question comes up when you think about like a film version of it. If you had a film version of it, somebody would have to compose this fictional sonata or enough of it to, you know, the audience would have to hear it, right? So that's kind of a fun thing to contemplate. But no, I mean, if an audiobook does get done, we will have to make some decisions about the music.
Well, the book is Sonata in Wax, a novel, and it is the latest work by our guest, Edward Hamlin, who has been our guest here at the Radio Book Club. And please subscribe to the podcast because we're going to have further conversation with Edward in our podcast only version after hours at the Radio Book Club. But in the meantime, we're going to say goodbye to our radio audience. Thank you, Edward, so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, as we always do at the end of each radio episode, we announce what we're reading for the next month. So, Arsene, what have we got lined up for February?
Well, we're going to be reading Peter Heller, who is one of our most frequent guests on the show. And this book called The Orchard is a real change of pace for him. And it's about two women and a young girl up in Vermont. And it's really a woman's story. And it's a very different piece of work for him.
It is. And it features a young girl in there. And it's lovely to read Peter's writing from the perspective of a young girl as well. So The Orchard is the February pick for the Radio Book Club. But don't forget, as I said, subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. From KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran. As always, my co-host for the Radio Book Club, Arsene Keshkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks, Arsene.
Thank you, Maeve.